This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. Your 150-year-old great-great-great-great-grandmother looks like she's 30. She lives in the same high-rise condo where you live. In fact, a whole generations and generations of your family live in the neighborhood. It sounds like a science fiction movie, but with the astoundingly rapid advance of gene therapy, stem cell therapies, nanotechnology, and other technologies, it's quite possible in our lifetime. Rather than stumbling and fumbling into long, long lifetimes, futurist Dr. Michael Zay is going to give us previews of coming attractions to help prepare us for an exciting future. Dr. Michael Zay is a professor, consultant, and speaker, and he's written several books, including his most recent book, Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. Today we're going to look at what the future is likely to hold in the next 10, 20, 50 years. Prepare to be amazed and wowed. Dr. Zay, welcome.
Well, welcome. Thank you for having me on.
I thought we'd look at body, mind, and spirit, starting with body. With genetic engineering, 5 years ago, the scientists mapped all of the human genes. What do you think genetic engineering is going to be able to accomplish in the next 10 years?
I think it's going to be accomplishing quite a bit in the next few years. First thing to keep in mind is when you said we mapped this out 5 years ago, we were already ahead by about 10 years in terms of when we were supposed to be accomplishing this. This should have been a signal right along that we were moving extremely rapidly to mastering, not just mapping this out, but applying these technologies, because this is the next step, is being able to eliminate diseases, being able to maybe even eliminate the diseases from a family history, say get rid of the tendency towards breast cancer, the tendency towards MS, that might be lying in the genetic structure. So genetic engineering, I would say, in the next, it's already starting to be applied to things like cystic fibrosis. We're finding breakthroughs that are taking place in the lab, dealing with muscular dystrophy, and eventually maybe even hair loss. There was just an announcement today that they've found another genetic, possible gene therapy for erectile dysfunction. Now, of course, it's in the early stages, as they always say, but a lot of the things that ail us will be approached one way or another through genetic engineering and gene therapy.
Yeah, it's amazing. The Genome Project got finished years ahead of time. What other projects get finished ahead of time?
By the way, that was through the miracle of competition from the private sector. Craig Venter, who now is trying to work on next step, now that he's part of the seas with helping us understand the genetic code, on the seventh day he's not resting. He is now trying to find the all-purpose energy source that will keep us in energy for the rest of eternity, and that's what his next project is. But it was actually his prodding, his work, that forced both the government into a high-speed version of cracking the code. And it's amazing what you can do when you really want to.
Gee, if we had Olympics working on this, imagine the progress we'd have. So of all the possible breakthroughs that we're likely to see, which ones do you think are most likely to hit in the next 10, 20 years?
One of the problems is getting information on this issue. And the reason I say that is we're kind of used to a process which I think is really becoming obsolete, in which you have some key scientists working in key institutions through the universities or university hospital affiliations, working on a quote-unquote project, very often with government funding, publishing through the journals, and that basically tells us where we are in terms of scientific progress and how far away we are from achieving something. That's not the case anymore, and I'm not trying to hedge my bets here, but there are Americans running off to China to get their hands on gene therapy for all sorts of arcane diseases. Now, some of these people come back claiming they're cured. A lot of this work is being done either entrepreneurially or through hospitals that are not part of the worldwide medical net, and it's very uneven. So when you say what will be out there, I think we'll probably find genetic cures for things like MS. I think we're going to see genetic engineering applied to, and stem cell research, stem cells also applied to things like spinal cord injuries, things where people thought they would be crippled for life will no longer be crippled. They will recover from that. And I think those would be some of the things, most of the diseases. I think it's very hard to say that they're going to cure cancer because cancer is such a multivariate type of problem. So it's hard to say, but I think in a lot of the diseases that we see, I wouldn't be surprised if we start applying this to Alzheimer's and various types of brain problems, brain diseases that we have. These are where you're seeing the breakthroughs take place at this point. The other issue, of course, is getting right into the genetic history of families and eliminating diseases, in which case you wouldn't see the quote-unquote results of this for 60, 70, 80 years, because it would mean that I would eliminate the tendency towards developing, say, breast cancer in successive generations. So one's grandchildren would actually benefit from this. Suddenly they wouldn't develop this type of disease.
Well, I'm fascinated with the paradigm shift you say there is and how the research is getting disseminated. It sounds a little like the way the internet works. People just go and do it, and then is it a viral kind of...
Absolutely, because one of the interesting coincidences was around the time that the Scottish breakthrough with cloning took place in 1997, was right around the time that the internet was starting to take hold in a way that people could meaningfully get their hands on information. And I was always amazed at how quickly we had, by 1998, 1999, information from Korea and places like that where they were cloning different types of, they were trying cloning animals. There were rumors that in South Korea, some of the scientists had begun the process of cloning humans, which stopped very quickly because of public outcry when the word came out. But the information, it does not take decades for this information to work its way around the globe. And given the way that people, I mean, think of the way people develop computers. And once you had the basic technology there, people were inventing and reinventing different parts of computers all over the world. It is certainly viral. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I just gave a talk on medical, so-called medical tourism, which is really medical travel, people traveling from their country of origin to another country to get the treatments that are either not found in their country, not found at the price they want.
Right, we did a show on that a couple weeks ago.
Right, and even as I was doing the talk, I was getting so much anecdotal information from the audience, people in the healthcare field, people who were just patients who went to China and got the kind of gene therapy that supposedly doesn't exist for whatever the disease was. So this is opening up an area. And now with the internet, it's not just transmitting the information about how does one cure a disease, but the information that cures might exist somewhere. Now you're going to have a lot of false leads, but there is a spontaneous fact-checking that takes place on the internet. It's not always accurate, but you do get enough anecdotal information from people saying, I did this, tried that, or I know someone who did it. And if someone comes up with false information, there are enough people to rebut them, and you don't have to follow leads blindly. You can contact the people who are making the claims. You can talk to them, and there's this kind of information float that exists out there that makes the obtaining of this medical treatment a lot easier. So, I mean, the millions of people that are doing this now is just, it's just extraordinary.
Wikipedia is a great example of fact-checking and how things work out. It sounds like the model for getting your research out is to do something very dramatic and very visual, like cloning Dolly, and get the magazines and newspapers to pick up the story, and then it attracts the funding.
Yes, and even the funding process, as you probably know, is there are now websites out there in which any of us can contribute $50 to a new band so that they can get funding for cutting a record or getting funding for research or startups. So even the flow of capital does not necessarily have to go through, well, whatever's left of our financial structure now, our financial institutions. It can actually find its way into a lot of different corners so that it's now becoming a lot easier to just get that kind of funding for this types of projects. Yeah, I mean, zines are important, and certainly cable news is a big venue, which is another venue that didn't exist 20 years ago in any meaningful sense. But this is one of the ways that the internet certainly contributes to moving the medical model forward.
Where on the internet do you look for reliable information about breakthroughs?
Well, I mean, for breakthroughs, just like anyone else, I start with Google News. Because I'm a university professor, I have access to certain maybe medical journals, but the journals sometimes are behind the rest of the population. I'm going to be on the Discovery website in a few weeks dealing with the issue of human enhancement because they have a program coming out about this, but a lot of what they're producing, where I consider it newsworthy, because it's not just their programs, but it's all the ancillary information that you get through their magazine and their website. Plus, I go to a lot of these conferences, like the World Future Society. At a lot of these meetings, you'll get people who are doing work, even sometimes they're financial analysts who are doing work on tapping into these breakthrough companies. So I get a lot of this information through my own private sources. Sometimes they're not so private, but you go to conferences and you hear people talking about the next breakthroughs in the applications of this information. Some of what went into Ageless Nation, my book, was information I had gotten at a conference that really was got very little publicity, which makes you worry about how much information doesn't get out there. But it was a conference that dealt with which they called Creating Older People. They wanted to talk about how you would extend life there, and just sitting through an 8-hour series of lectures by people who are approaching one problem, extending life, life's extension, but from about 5 different perspectives, so different scientifically that none of them had ever talked to each other about this, even though they were all working on the same problem, but one was in genetic engineering, one other areas. So I check those out. I look at websites that might be an advocacy group. For instance, one of the areas that I'm very concerned about is something called caloric restriction, which maybe you've done a show on already, which is essentially the work that's been done on restricting calories dramatically in animals, etc., and extended their lifespans well beyond expectations. And there are reasons why this happens. Well, one of the places I go looking for research is like the Caloric Restriction Society has a website. This is people who actually are not just interested in the research, but are actually using themselves.
The skinniest conference in the world.
Yeah. I mean, the Caloric Restriction Society of people who restrict their calories dramatically.
These are the anorexics that know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, they're looking at all the research out there. So those websites, again, you talk about the internet connection, they will point you to articles which one may not know about. But sometimes information is just not as available as you would like it. So one goes to conferences, private discussions you have with people who are involved in the field, seeing where they're going. They may have things that's not ready for publication, and you get some information that way.
If you were a layperson and you said, instead of taking the usual beach vacation, I'm going to do something different and go to a conference on the future, what conference would you go, or how would you find a conference that would be interesting to a layperson?
Oh, if anyone is able to go to the World Future Society annual conference, they're WFS, it's just World Future Society, WFS.org. I talk there all the time, and one was interested in the future. They have these conferences that just bring people talking about the future of, and just fill in the blank. Could be medicine, it could be the future of the military, the future of terrorism, the future of security. Ones they went to, there's so much there. It starts like 8 in the morning, goes on to 11 at night every day. And you have to set your watch, you have to start from the beginning. And there are times when there are 3 or 4 sessions going on at the same time that you wish you could go to. It's real education. And they have state-by-state offshoots. They have branches where you can go to their conferences. New Jersey has one, California, I believe, has one, D.C. has one, and they have sites, chapters in places as far as Venezuela. So it really is the World Future Society. And you get some big politicos sometimes showing up. Newt Gingrich was there 1 year, talking about the future. It certainly is a place to go. I mean, if you were just starting, that is a great introduction. I'm not plugging the organization, but since you asked.
Yeah. Well, getting back to genetic engineering, you talked about it, curing diseases, preventing diseases. Is the day going to come where you can go to a genetic boutique, bring a picture of an early Sophia Loren and say, make me look like that?
Well, people do that anyway, and the way we approach that is not through genetic engineering. We use the cut-and-paste method of reconstructing people's faces at this point. We use
Photoshop?
don't think it's just going to be genetic engineering. To me, genetic engineering may be considered a fairly slow way of approaching some of these facial and rejuvenation processes. If nanotechnology ever matures, and the real nanotechnology, where we're able to manipulate molecules and cells at the molecular level, we'll be able to change anything, almost into anything else, and that would include creating body parts, changing skin. That would be done on the spot. In fact, I deal with issues within the book about this whole concept of rejuvenation. It's within the realm of possibility to the point that presidential commissions are out there, like the President's Council on Bioethics has looked at these possibilities as very real. They're not really supportive of them, believe it or not. But at least this current go-round with this administration, the President's Council on Bioethics has been not very concerned about life extension. They're very concerned about preventing diseases. But when you start going into areas like rejuvenation, there really becomes a question of whether they would actually support something like that. But again, you know, with something like nanotechnology, where you literally can start to change matter itself, concepts like rejuvenation might be very possible. Now, when is that going to happen? Well, the question is, when does nanotechnology make the breakthrough that everyone's waiting for, which is the ability to make atoms behave in the way that we'd like them to, which they don't. They have their own mind. I mean, they're obviously, I mean, it certainly would be, let's say, tampering or mastering nature at a level that is literally mind-boggling.
What kind of scientists are working on this? Are these the same people doing genetic engineering and stem cell therapies?
No. One of the organizations that is at the forefront of this is called the Foresight Institute, which is overseen by somebody named Kenneth Drexler. And he was actually the person who, I believe, introduced the concept of nanotechnology to refer to this whole process by which we would be basically controlling molecular engineers, would just have molecular machines. I mean, they're talking about developing molecular-sized machines, kind of like computer-based robots, but at the molecular level, that would be literally able to go through the bloodstream and find, say, an AIDS virus, search and destroy it, repair the cells, and come out again, and touch nothing else, because it literally would be programmed to do it. It's not a bacillus, it's not an antitoxin, it's literally a machine. That's why when I say it's not the same people, it's really engineers that are working on this, not biologists. Now, in a sense, both of these fields find each other, biology and physics, but it's really incredible when you see what the possibilities are. I mean, then you're talking about the fountain of youth.
What's been literally the biggest accomplishment in nanotechnology so far?
The accomplishment right now is that they've been able to arrange atoms, and they did this in the 90s, to such as that the atoms behaved, I think they were silicon atoms, so that they could spell out IBM, or IBM, which was actually quite an accomplishment. A lot of times when you hear nanotechnology referred to in the financial news and the pop culture science that you see on cable news, and they're really talking about miniaturization, getting things down to what they call the nano level. That, and if you look at what those accomplishments are, well, they're able to do very fine machine work, very fine manufacturing, but it's really not the kind of breakthrough in physics that would allow you to transform matter from one form to another.
So the word's being used in two different ways.
It is, and it drives people in the field crazy because it was co-opted, so to the point where financial analysts will talk about the top 10 companies in nanotechnology and really be talking about companies that are getting things to the nano level, which is defined as super small to begin with, but they're actually talking about miniaturization, which is something we've done for years. Real nano would be to be able to control the atom, not just split it, make it do things, but actually control it so that I can transmute, say, soot into a chair, that level of transformation. So when you're thinking of that, then you think about what real rejuvenation would be. People have talked about setting the cells back to an earlier stage, which would actually rejuvenate a person. And the implications of this, of course, are incredible. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was looking at the possibilities and the implications.
So the purest definition of nanotechnology, we're talking about very theoretical scientists at this point.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier enhancement. When will we get to the point where we can have better than normal hearing, better than normal vision as a result of scientific advances?
Well, the better hearing part has already taken place. It is amazing that people who were near deaf with the use of the cochlear implants, C-O-C-H-L-E-A-R implants, are able to hear now. And that improvement has been so dramatic, it kind of crept up on people. It got some notoriety because several years ago, a very famous and very affluent talk show host, Rush Limbaugh, lost his hearing in a matter of, which is very frightening, in a matter of 4 months, went from hearing to no hearing. And though it was viral, they think, in Nature, he went and got this operation for this. He couldn't survive as a talk show host if he was going to have someone signal to him about what the, you know, if he just spoke and then had someone tell him what the guests were saying.
But his hearing isn't normal yet. You talked about implants and sensors that would enable us to even hear frequencies that we can't hear, or with vision, see frequencies that we can't see.
Well, you know, it's funny, when we talk about life, increasing life expectancy, there's this, just to put this in perspective, there's this second huge trend, and which I call the ultra-human phenomenon. I don't like the word superhuman, even though Discovery Channel is going to use that as their, I think that is the current working title of the show that's coming out in a few months called Superhuman, but I call it ultra-human because I don't really think of it as super, but the human enhancement revolution is certainly something that is kind of washing over society, and we're not even aware of the revolution because we always think of individual issues. A person went deaf, I'm going to give the person the hearing back. That's the cochlear implant. However, suppose you want super hearing. Suppose you want to not only be able to hear normally, but you want to be able to hear frequencies. You want to be able to, maybe you feel that you could get some implant that would allow you to hear music at a heightened level. It certainly would be possible. People are starting to require their technologies is to heighten the living experience beyond what we have. We only see things in three basic colors, green, blue, and yellow, I guess. But what is reality? We're not really seeing reality because one could have a heightened sense of seeing colors even
right,
beyond.
Right, just a slice of reality now.
Right, and maybe seeing things in several different dimensions and being able to, when I look at something, I don't see the chemical composition or the atomic composition. I see with my eye whatever it resolves to. I mean, we say perfect vision. But that even getting into that, if we don't even think of like the super, superhuman level, people have, originally people were getting LASIK surgery because they didn't like the way they were seeing things. Then you saw people with 20/65, very acceptable vision, wanting to get LASIK surgery. I've known people who've done this so that they can get themselves to 20/10. I don't have 20/10 vision, but I know what it does for sports stars. Mm-hmm. It certainly is a question of you will be much more successful as a baseball player with 20/10 vision. In fact, psychological tests, and they've done surveys, have shown that the people who make it to the major leagues, I think it was like 40-42% of them had better than 20/20 to begin with. Now, I don't know if it was 2015. Some of the best players have had 20/10. So the question is, can I do more? Can I be more effective at this ultra vision? And that's just an example. Will everyone at some point want to be able to see things better? Is that what they're requiring? Do they have to hear? They want to make sure they hear every note in every part of a spectrum when they listen to a classical concert.
Are there athletes that have already had surgery to get 20/10 vision?
I don't know if they did it specifically, but I know that one of the players for the Yankees, and nobody talks about this because they're always complaining about steroids and all of these other enhancements. And my question is, are we going to ban, if we don't want people to take steroids, are we going to ban typical operations, which are not just therapeutic, but are, call it beyond therapy, enhancement? And there's this argument. And Bernie Williams, who was, my own opinion was, he had his career extended by several years when he had LASIK surgery. He never hid the fact that he did it. He was doing ads in the New York area for this one particular hospital practice where he had the surgery done. He was telling how wonderful it was. I can't imagine he was seeing it worse. He was having eye problems. So to what extent are we only to get people back to 2020? Is it cheating? You know, the question is it cheating at 2010?
Oh, futurism is just fraught with ethical issues. We're talking with Dr. Michael Zay, author of the fascinating book Ageless Nation, The Quest for Superlongevity and Physical Perfection. We'll get back to Dr. Zay in a minute and learn more about how the future is going to affect families and lifestyles and some of the sticky ethical issues. But first, a word from our sponsor. Do you have a burning desire to help people? Do you have an interest in health and wellness? Are you looking to change or add to your career? Consider becoming a professional health coach. The U.S. Department of Labor predicts a substantial increase in employment for fitness and health professionals. Create your own business with job security, high demand, and rapid growth. Train with experts step by step. You will learn how you can work from anywhere using $2 million internet software to build and run your own coaching practice. You can work with personal clients, gyms, sports clinics, and small and large businesses. Be ready to earn income in as little as 90 days. To get the free facts and training with no obligation, go to healthcoachtraining.com/Judith. That's healthcoachtraining.com/Judith to get your first free lesson and a guided tour of the training software. Then on October 1st at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Judith will have a live teleseminar on how she has helped others. The link is rather complicated, and I know some of you are driving or doing other things, so I'll put both of those links on agelesslifestyles.com so you can just click on them when you're at your computer. A reminder, if you'd like information on any of my services, my speaking services, personal coaching by phone, books, hypnosis CDs, or my free email newsletter, just go to my portal site, notaging.com, that's notaging.com, and it will take you to the information you need. And now back to Dr. Zay. Dr. Zay, your book is a fascinating read. The website is zay.com. Boy, that was a coup. Z-E-Y.com.
Well, as a futurist.
And it has articles and videos and your blog. I'd like to switch to mind. Can I someday get an implant that will have all that Spanish vocabulary so I don't have to memorize it?
Possibly, but you won't go through the pleasure of learning the language. You may not be able to speak it. It'll be in your mind. There are a lot of people who work in this field of intellectual and mental enhancement. Very controversial. Extremely controversial. I wrote about it in the book. As I mentioned, there will be an article of mine called The Human Enhancement Revolution on the Discovery.com website, and the reason I mention it is because a lot of this is definitely fresh in my mind and dealing with the ethical issues around mental capacity already, and this was not publicized. There are drugs out there which some people want to call smart drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they smart drugs? Well, let me just say, if anyone's taking it for the purpose of making you more alert or smarter, you're taking it off-label, because most of these drugs were invented for people with narcolepsy, people who were literally falling asleep in their chairs, who had sleep apnea. However, some of them, like Provigil, which is now getting a lot of notoriety, has evidently the ability to keep people focused. We don't say alert. It's not alert in the sense of the old, as far as I know, the old amphetamines, which became an incredible social problem in the 70s and 80s, the speed epidemic, and even today with methamphetamine. It seems to be a different family of drugs. They've changed the molecules. So it keeps people focused. Does it make them smarter? Nature magazine. They're read by a lot of scientists, researchers, technicians, mathematicians, whoever. And they just did a quick and dirty survey. Nothing scientific, quote-unquote, no pun intended, about this survey. And they found out that 20% of the respondents are using something like either Adderall, Provigil, some or other related drugs that help alertness. We can call them smart drugs, but they're already in use. Dig deep enough into chat rooms, which is one of the ways I do my research. You will find that medical students are using these. They're being used by people for studying. There's a real debate about this. Is it fair for one person to be taking an SAT?
Well, it sounds like so far it's just improving concentration rather.
And memory, also, I forgot to mention.
How does it improve memory?
I don't know the scientific reason, but one of them actually, people claim that if they're studying in the alert state, they're digesting the information a lot quicker.
That sounds like enhancing attention and concentration as opposed to memory, and we get that from caffeine and amphetamines and a number of other medications.
I'm not suggesting that people ought to do this. I'm suggesting that it's pretty widespread.
Well, I'm surprised we haven't done more with biofeedback and brainwaves to get people in an optimal brainwave to enhance learning and memory.
Yes, biofeedback can be used for everything from migraines to just to relaxation itself and to control one's blood pressure. And people, I've gone through biofeedback years ago. It's a slow process. Slow in the sense one has to train one's body over four or five sessions to really begin to get your body
right.
Biofeedback, by the way, I really believe in, because it really is mastery of oneself, getting oneself into an alpha state or whatever brainwave state one would want to, certainly would help. But, you know, you could talk about the sociological reasons why people have chosen more of a drug mechanism. Now, also, speaking of use of machinery, though, there is work being done on an area called transcranial magnetic machinery that actually is used to stimulate areas of the brain, and they found that this has helped short-term cognition.
Mm-hmm.
Popular Science had this very pop article showing people in the future going to a brain boutique where they would suddenly have their brains energized externally. It looks like a hairdryer. And you're having your brain...
It's right next to the gym.
Right, that's right. Again, we get into the ethical areas, and I deal with this in my article on Discovery, the question of, is it ethical or unethical to be temporarily smarter than someone else? And the question, of course, gets, yes, if it's an SAT test, and someone comes in there with their memory being jogged and their concentration at absolute peak level, where every question just goes directly into the cerebral cortex, just digested, and they're able to see this, and they can reading comprehension becomes so much easier. That you may have a question about whether this is fair or not. On the other hand, if I have a team of scientists that are working for the cure for AIDS or the cure for cancer, they make the breakthrough because they were working at optimum intellectual levels. Is that cheating? Well, they got a Nobel Prize quicker, perhaps, than someone else who can say it was unfair. But in the real world, as a recipient of the benefits of their research, I don't think they cheated. I wouldn't think that is. I think they got me to the stage where I'm going to save my life.
I don't either. And the trickle down of scientific knowledge is just spinning so fast that it will get to everybody very quickly within several years, probably.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
More than half the world now has cell phones. It's amazing.
Yes.
Your background is actually in sociology. I don't know how we can convince people of the possibility that people are going to live to 150 or 300 or even possibly forever, but let's take a leap of faith. If that happens, if people are living hundreds of years or even longer, are ministers going to be out of work?
No, because the question is, will religion be challenged? So much of what we think of as religion is based on ideas of the finite nature of life, the afterlife, the relationship between man and a God who is supposedly controlling so much of our lives. And now we've reached points where we're living to a tremendous age, and if we so desire, possibly forever. I think what certainly our religious beliefs are going to be challenged in ways. I don't think it's necessarily going to make people unreligious. I think from the moral perspective, the fact that I am going to live in the future and I can't pass on my bad decisions to a generation that will have to live with these decisions after I'm long gone will certainly change the urgency with which and the importance of the decisions I make today. I think it's going to confront people, even though people fear death. So much of what they do and say is actually uses the possibility of death as an excuse. I'll give an example. You talk about something horrible that's developing in the country or in the world, some development, whatever it is, the possibility of nuclear holocaust or whatever. Very often people will say, well, fortunately, I won't be around to deal with this. I won't have to live through it. Death actually gives us an escape, and that escape won't be there, certainly not in the near future. And if I'm going to live to 300 years and do so as a relatively young person, I'm going to have to be a lot more serious about my planning. I'm going to have to be a lot more serious about what I do for my next generations, even with my own family, because my great-great-grandchildren are going to be around. And possibly the things I've done and said today could come back to haunt me, and certainly I could be held accountable for. And worse, I won't even have the excuse of being old. They can't say, well, cut the person a break because mm-hmm. the person is, they're 80. Well, that doesn't mean anything anymore. At 80, you're spry and running around, and everyone else who's 80 is in their third career, and they're building a better future for themselves and others. So why aren't you doing it? I think the moral issues, there might be some very positive moral developments that come out of this.
Well, we thought it was bad today that anything you say might be on the internet forever. It sounds like it's going to get 100 times worse. It also sounds like clergy are going to evolve into a little less emphasis on passing on doctrine and liturgy and addressing the big issues of life and the way that life is changing.
Yeah, I think we're going to need the guidance of pastoral counseling to deal with my marriage, which is now in my 103rd year. I think the issues of living with multi-generations in itself has a lot of positives to it, but I think it's going to bring up some social issues that we've never had before in terms of responsibility and the responsibilities to the future generations. The very things that will help us get to where we are, to be, have super longevity, near immortality, if you want, will begin to change our concept of ourselves and certainly our concept of ourselves in relation to the universe and therefore to God, to the Godhead. If we're this powerful, the idea is always one is becoming, we think that's becoming godlike, which is actually not such a negative thing if you think mm-hmm. about it. I mean, it's in a sense getting people in touch with enormous human potential, which I think is actually has a very positive moral bend to it, because the more power you have, the more responsibility, the more good you can do. And I think those are the questions that are going to come. What is it that we can do to improve the environment, but eventually the universe? And I think those possibilities are going to bring us to probably a whole level of theology that we're not even thinking about at this point, probably can't even conceive of, because we haven't had the objective external mm-hmm. conditions that are now becoming part of our everyday life.
And when you wrote about family, it really got me thinking. On the one hand, I love the idea of if you don't really connect with your mother, maybe your grandmother, your great-great-grandmother. I mean, there's so many more mentors to choose from. As a therapist, I've been amazed at how many people had just terrible, terrible childhoods. And I said, well, who really parented you? And it was grandma. That was what got him through it all. But on the other hand, I think of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or the TV series Dallas, and I say, oh, what a nightmare. And these multi-generational families may just be the kid who doesn't want to leave home and wants mommy to take care of him the rest of his life.
I agree with you. One of the interesting aspects of the research I did for Ageless Nation was discovered that a lot of the new housing that is being built is this multi-generational housing, where the house actually is set up in such a way that not only can the college student who wants to return home to college actually live in kind of a semi-separate environment in the same house, but you can also have as rooms, you know, we always hear of the mother-daughter family. Well, they're actually building lots of these. I had an example in the book where some noted anesthesiologist or doctor had bought a few houses in a cul-de-sac, one for each for different generations and offshoots of the family. And he did it because the desire was on the part of the members of the family to live within, you know, the separate but close. I mean, we used to call this neighborhoods, I guess, but people are actually in our suburbanized, atomized lifestyle. They're looking for some sort of connection with their own families. I think one indication that people actually respond, well, a few indications. First of all, I was at a conference last year in Key Biscayne, where I was giving a talk on America at 400 million, and we're moving into this much larger society by 2050, 2040. And one of the presenters there was somebody from MTV who had just done research on the four or five different personality types of youth between 14 and 19, I guess, their target age area. And they said one of the things they told them was that the respondents like their parents. I remember the 60s mm-hmm. and the 70s and the concept of the generation gap. Well, there's always a kind of a generation gap that's been that way since the beginning of time, but the kind of distrust that you saw back in, I guess, the ages of the counterculture back in the early, mid-late 20th century seems to be dissipating, and there's a much closer relationship between the parents, and this is something that they discovered in their research. Of course, they will market to those needs, I'm sure, in all of their shows. The other thing I noticed, and I was struck and I was stung by the fact that this movie that came out about 3 or 4 years ago called My Big Fat Greek Wedding, mm-hmm. which was produced for something like the paltry $600,000 and ended up grossing hundreds of millions of dollars, keyed into a need, I believe, for connectedness across the generations. And yeah. I think it's something that's interestingly coming back just at a time when people are living much longer than they did even a century ago.
I think with so much change and so much choice, people are feeling a need for some foundation and some roots. When I was reading what you wrote about multi-generational, I started thinking of the Amish communities and how they build a little house for grandmother and grandmother right behind the main house.
And we consider those people out of step. Or we have for so many years that I barely see any charm in it, and now suddenly, guess what? You know, we're kind of coming around to that thinking.
There are so many ethical issues. You know, people get concerned about population growth. How can we, the world, handle all these people? The ethics of messing with God or Mother Nature, fairness, this just a rich people thing. Is there any ethical issue that bothers you?
The ethical issues that I see are, obviously, coming from my point of view, I don't like governments or gurus or self-appointed guardians of our morals telling us what we should be and what we can turn ourselves into. I don't like to see people, just because they're uncomfortable with it, telling me how enhanced I can actually be. And I think it's unethical to actually restrict people's ability to expand their human potential to whatever they can be. So from an ethical point of view, I don't want to see this become a political battle. I don't want to see too much interference from government in the development of these issues. So I have that bothers me. The second thing that worries me is that we're not being prepared for this age in any way. And I don't mean that the government isn't doing it, but the educational institutions aren't really preparing people for a very long haul. Kids today could very easily live to 150 with only a minor tweaking of some of the sciences that are being developed at this time. And I even suggested in the book that we develop something called, which I developed a little program called Super Longevity Training, where you go into the grade schools, the high schools, the universities, and get people for being trained for super longevity. And it bothers me that the issues are not being dealt with and not being confronted to at least tell people you're going to be here for a long time, and that, you know, we should help people plan for this, to talk about not just financial planning, but thinking in terms of several careers and thinking about what the implications are.
I think the only place it's happening is in some sci-fi movies.
I know, and unfortunately, the science fiction, it's also very reflective of the mindset of the society today. And
often the mindset of the 50s. I mean,
it is, well, science fiction. If I see one more movie about the future, which looks like bleak with burned out buildings and run by an authoritarian government that you don't see. I mean, these things, maybe they're great warnings for us in a sense, but I don't see too many. I remember 2001, the movie, and how uplifting and how just expanding of the human spirit that was, even though people, you know, it was in a sense frightening in a lot of ways in terms of what computers could become, etc. But at least it talked about human destiny, human possibilities, human potential, even with all of its warnings. But I just don't see that anymore. I saw one science fiction cartoon called WALL-E, and it was very engrossing. It was a cartoon, but it basically showed humans to be not very, you know, you give humans all the comforts of life and, you know, they became basically just totally useless individuals who were actually being manipulated by their own machines, which, you know, maybe it could be a warning, but it gave more humanity to an amorphous robot, two robots, in fact, than it did to any human being. Science fiction today should be mind games for a future that could happen and that we're evolving into, and let people have sitcoms dealing with people where grandpa looks 110, looks 28. Play with it. Let's start doing the mind experiments now that will be necessary for us to get ourselves out of our prejudices and get ourselves out of our stereotypes about what one is supposed to be at 60 or 70 or 80. Because I think those stereotypes start to feed back into individuals, and they start to limit themselves based on the attitudes that people have towards them. I think that whole cultural ethos about aging has to change so that people can actually grow and not have those prejudices act as a limiting force on them.
So just to recap, your biggest ethical concerns are keeping government out of it and having more education coming from the private sector.
Yes, and I've used the term in the book that people have to become health sleuths, health detectives. A lot of these new technologies are not going to be handed to you through your, it's not like you're going to get a vaccine to make you live forever. If there are technological breakthroughs, very often the information will not be widely distributed, nor will the therapies. They may not even be occurring in your country. So it's really up to us as individuals to make that future for ourselves, because the information and the technologies might be there, but no one is delivering it to your door.
We've been talking with Dr. Michael Zay, author of Ageless Nation, The Quest for Super Longevity and Physical Perfection. His website is zay.com, that's Z-E-Y.com, which has articles, videos, and your blog. Dr. Zay, absolutely fascinating. Really appreciate you sharing this glimpse into the future, and all I can say is wow.
Well, you know, I invite anyone who listens to this to share their own feelings and thoughts about this through zay.com. It's very easy to contact me, very accessible, and I'd really like insights into what people's own attitudes have been on their own experiences with aging, medical tourism, whatever it is, because I'm always interested in conversing with people about this issue.
Wonderful. Commentary. So what did we learn from Dr. Zay? We learned that genetic engineering, stem cell therapies, and miniaturization are full speed ahead, but nanotechnology, in the purest sense of the term, rearranging atoms, hasn't had its breakthrough yet. Dr. Zay's description of nanotechnology reminded me of the 1987 movie Inner Space, in which Martin Short was miniaturized and navigates through the human body, or the 1966 movie Fantastic Voyage, in which a crew of scientists, and Raquel Welch was one of the scientists, are miniaturized and remove a blood clot in a scientist's brain. I don't know how strong a case we built that baby boomers may well live to 150 or perhaps even 300 or longer. I don't say forever, partly because events like auto accidents can put a real crimp in longevity. But the technology is advancing so fast that it is quite possible that some boomers may live hundreds of years. To illustrate, let's look at the three most feared diseases of aging. As we heard from Dr. Shimp last week, a vaccine for atherosclerosis seems likely, heart transplants from pigs seem likely, and treatment of cardiovascular disease is becoming more efficient and less invasive every few years. Researchers are making progress with Alzheimer's disease on many fronts, including medication and the on-again-off-again vaccine trials with humans. While we still aren't very good at preventing the various forms of cancer, early detection and effective treatment are showing better and better track records every year. The trick isn't being healthy enough today that you could live 100 years. Rather, you need to reach the next decade in fairly good health to take advantage of those advances, and so on with each succeeding decade. I think of it as the healthy longevity cavalry is on the way. We need to keep the troops in good shape until the cavalry gets here. What we did do on the show was explore some of the fascinating implications of longevity. Living longer changes your perspective on achievement and responsibility. There's no wooden leg excuses for being old if you're mentally and physically sharp at 80 or 100 or 120. It creates mind-boggling extended families with the wonderful benefits that go with that. And with enough possible conflict to keep a family therapist working full-time with just one family. The possibilities of having enhanced hearing, enhanced vision, and even learning and memory are exciting. It's like having the powers of the cyborg in the Terminator, only being the human instead of being the robot. Baby steps! I always like to leave you with some little tweaks, some little baby steps to help you live longer, healthier, and happier, which is the purpose of our program. There are quite a few things that we need to do to take care of ourselves. We need to watch our investments and finances. We need to watch our eating habits. We need to monitor our health and pay special attention to any risk factors or health problems we have. We need to keep up on our professions or careers. And we need to keep an eye on the future and future developments. Of course, one of the best ways to do that is listening to Ageless Lifestyles. So the baby step today is to try to average at least an hour a week paying attention to what the future is likely to bring, particularly the future for health and the future for lifestyle issues. How do you do this? Whatever works best for you. Maybe you get it off the internet, magazines like Scientific American, Discover, in newspapers, in journals, TV programs like Nova, programs on NPR radio, listening to my podcast, whatever works for you. Emails. As you know, I love getting emails. The emails about the show last week with Dr. Shimp on the future of medicine touched on several topics. A couple frustrated physicians and therapists concurred on how the way insurance companies limit reimbursement to face-to-face contact is making American healthcare very inefficient. A couple of listeners wrote about how they still have difficulty believing that you can get a kidney through a navel. Intellectually, I know it's true, but I too still find it very hard to believe. Finally, a couple of listeners wrote about family members who have had shingles and how horrible it is and how glad they are to learn that there's a vaccine. I'd love to hear from you. Send your emails to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. I'm pleased to tell you that I've been invited to speak in an exclusive speaking platform for the public to learn about health and wellness. The seminars are free and feature leading national and international experts in health and wellness. I'm sure you'll recognize many of the names. My seminar will give a good overview of my anti-aging ABCs, the attitudes, beliefs, and coping skills for living longer, healthier, and happier. Mark your calendar for October 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time to hear the seminar. The site has many other seminars by well-renowned experts you want to hear as well. All are free, but you do have to register at healthteleclass.com. That's healthteleclass.com, and I'll also put that link on agelesslifestyles.com. A reminder for information about my services, speaking services, personal coaching by phone, books, hypnosis CDs, or my free email newsletter, just go to my portal site, notaging.com, that's notaging.com, and it will link you to the information you want. This is anti-aging psychologist Dr. Michael Bricky on webtalkradio.net. The last half dozen programs are available on webtalkradio.net. You can stream them or download them as an MP3. All of the previous programs are also on agelesslifestyles.com, where you can stream them or download them. I hope the show has helped you gain some new ideas and enhanced passion. And thank you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.